solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
So the skylight, I mean, that's in the old wisdom schools, people talk about the observer, right? Or the witness consciousness. You're witnessing yourself whilst you're in action. And the skylight is actually a simple metaphor practice where you imagine yourself looking down on yourself from a skylight and you see yourself act, you feel yourself feel, and you listen to yourself talk whilst you're in action. And that's a very important practice to master, that witness consciousness.
Welcome to the 99th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations from leading people from various domains on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. Just like businesses think about where to play and how to win in the context of their strategy, we all think about the two questions, where to go and how to grow, at various points in our lives. And these questions become that much harder in a world of abundance, multiplicity of options, and limited feedback. Through this podcast, I hope to share some insights that might help you navigate these questions in a more thoughtful way. While podcasting accounts for 10 to 20% of my time and effort, my primary vocation is that of an executive coach on a discrete sounding board with CEOs, entrepreneurs, investors, advisors, and other business leaders. I engage with leaders and organizations with a growth mindset and help them play to their unique potential. You can learn more about the podcast and my work at playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. My guest this time is Mikhail Kriut, co-author of Deliberate Calm, How to Learn and Lead in a Volatile World, a book that's very relevant for the times we live in. There are many things that he says which could be incredibly valuable to the listeners, but of the various things we discussed, I really liked his insights around the ladder of self-awareness and how we can slowly move up the ladder. In many conversations in this podcast, we've explored the topic of self-awareness, but I really liked how Mikhail provides a structure and a gradation to how we can slowly move up the curve. We also spoke about the metaphor of an iceberg in a collective context. While we speak about icebergs while referring to individuals, he speaks about how teams also have collective icebergs, and it's important to recognize that and deal with that. Without further ado, let's tune into the conversation with Mikhail Kriut.
Mikhail, thanks so much for making the time for the Play to Potential podcast. Really excited to be talking to you.
Nice to be here, Deepak. Very nice.
And in this podcast, we are curious about people's journeys. So before we dive into talking about your recent book, Deliberate Calm, tell us a little bit about your journey and more specifically, some of the key transition points. You know, I was particularly intrigued by a couple of points in your journey, HUL to McKinsey, and then McKinsey to what you do now. But maybe there are more. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about your journey, especially some of the pivots along the way.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So I studied in economics, and then I joined Unilever and really enjoyed it. So I thought when I joined, well, let's do it for 2 years and then I'll see where it ends up. But it was so much fun that I actually had a really nice 14-15 years with them, with a couple of highlights, running the global Magnum ice cream brand out of the Innovation Center in Rome, which was very exciting, and then moving to Palm Beach, Florida, where we bought SlimFast, a weight loss company, and that was also a transition point for me, and I had a couple in my career. This was one, and it was basically the SlimFast period was quite intense. It was a company that we kept outside Unilever, and it grew double digit. But it was the weight loss business, right? So it could also go double digit the other way around. And at some point after 2 years, that happened. And long story short, at some point, I got a thyroid infection as stress related, right? So we were in a downward market situation. We got stuck in our management team. We had lots of tough discussions, but couldn't make tough decisions. At least it took too long according to my my standards. And I got a choice from a doctor, either to take out my thyroid or to look at the psychosomatic background. So I did the latter, and that was super impactful. And actually, I think it might have actually have been the early seed of this book, because at that point I got very much in touch with awareness work and deep transformational work. So becoming aware of patterns and learning how to transform unproductive patterns into productive patterns for myself. Now, what happened to me when I started doing that work were two things. One is every time I learned something new about myself, I got more influence back in the office because I could stop blaming my colleagues and start changing myself, which is a lot easier than waiting for others to change.
And you were working with somebody in this period, Mikhail, or just self?
Yeah, I was actually part of a group. It was a group work, so lots of people. Basically, the work was around helping people discover their blind spots, what was in between you and your potential. Mm-hmm. And it was based on Adlerian psychology. So I've done that for a year or so, and in that year, my physical condition totally went away without medicine. And as I said, every time I got an insight, I got more influence back in the office, but I also felt my thyroid slow down. So I was burning when I, at the top of this condition, I was burning 8,000 calories a day, which is like you're continuously running a marathon. It's quite intense. Yeah. So that was a transition. That was not so much a transition, but it was something that brought a practice into my life that excited me so much and had such a personal impact on me that it started to ignite a passion for something that I hadn't known before. Mm-hmm. And what then happened is it shifted, my interest shifted a little bit more towards this type of work and a little bit away from the marketing, sales, general management track I was on at Unilever. Mm-hmm. So after a while, I took a sabbatical and actually started to look at, you know, how can I bring this work into the boardrooms? Because, you know, we're not very well trained to handle change in boardrooms, specifically when it's really tough, right? When paradigms need to shift, when people need to change mindsets, when they need to change how they collaborate. So I thought, hey, what if I could bring this type of blind spot discovery work into boardrooms? It would solve a lot of problems. It certainly would have solved our problem if we would have gotten that skill into our team. So I took a sabbatical and interviewed everyone that had anything to do with working on the boundary between business change and people change, and ended up talking to a McKinsey senior partner, Michael Rennie, who just traveled to the U.S. to
based in Sydney, right? Wasn't he based in Sydney at some point?
Yeah, he was a Sydney. He was a Sydney, and he experimented with what McKinsey at the time called mindsets and behaviors. And basically, that was based on an insight that a lot of strategies were good strategies, but they didn't get executed, and they didn't get executed because people couldn't get their hearts and their minds around it. And there was not enough buy-in. And so this mindset and behavior work was actually there to help shift, let's say, the soft stuff in order to get the hard stuff done.
Got it. Now, I used to do some work with a gentleman called Bill Schanninger in New Jersey.
Yeah. Bill is also part of the org practice. Know him well. Yeah.
Correct. And he used to talk about Michael Rennie in Sydney. Got it.
Yeah, he was a special innovator. So when I met him, I thought, wow, you know, I never aspired to actually work for McKinsey. But when I met him, I thought, hey, this is where I, and I had another, I'll do this 2 years and then I'll see what happens. But then I ended up staying 15 years because I really enjoyed life at McKinsey and doing this work.
Yeah. And this was regular management consulting sort of in the McKinsey strategy, business, ops, sales, marketing kind of stuff? Or was it
focused on the transformation? No, it was very different because I only wanted to focus on this transformational work. So I joined Michael in this nascent practice that was called Mindsets and Behaviors. And we basically did only work with executive teams around the world to help them in their most difficult challenges, shifting their mindsets and behaviors. And then later on that turned into large-scale culture transformations work as well.
Got it. Lovely. Mikhail, moving to the book, Deliberate Calm. Can you talk us a little bit about how this book came about? Specifically, I think the topic of leadership and you know, associated themes have been studied, and there's sort of millions of titles. So I'm curious about what was the need that you were trying to fulfill with this piece of work?
Yeah, it's well, it actually brings me to another reflection moment I had in my career when I felt that my learning curve went a little bit down at McKinsey. I took a sabbatical in 2019 and I was having breakfast with Tammy Simon at a retreat in California. She is the founder of Sounds True. And she said, well, I'm doing this nice event. It's called, what was it called again? It was something like your inner MBA. So it was very intriguing. So I told her what I did. And she said, oh, wow, it would be interesting to do something together. But then you first need to write a book. Otherwise, no one knows who you are. So I thought, okay, how do I do that? And then we spoke a little bit about it. And then she actually triggered, I should actually send her a book now that we're talking about it. But she triggered me to start writing. But this was in 2019. I had time. I was on the sabbatical. So I started writing the outline and everything. And then the reason why I did it is one, I mean, she triggered it. But as we have done this work in the past 10, 15 years, lots of clients always asked, why don't you write a book about this? Because it's so intriguing and it's so useful. And we can't find anything that is related to our life. It's so applied. It's so applied to the work in the business world. We just can't find it. So very often you find books that are about the topic, but they're written by either academics or, but not by practitioners. So they were looking for that. And then probably the most important reason why I wrote it, and my co-authors should talk for themselves, of course, is that I wished I would have known all of this personal mastery stuff when I started working. So I hope my kids will actually read the book. They're now actually they're entering the work process more or less. I hope they will read the book and learn a bit for it and apply it so they don't have to go through a lot of the lessons that I had to go through.
That's a wonderful framing, actually. I sometimes think about that in the context of the podcast to say, you know, if my kids could find it of value, then that itself is ROI for the effort.
Exactly. And that whole generation. Yeah.
And just maybe going back to one thing you said, a couple of things you said, Mikhail, before we dive into the book. Now, you spoke about taking a sabbatical each time, you know, whether it was HUL to McKinsey or McKinsey to the current version of you. I find that interesting because very often when I work with leaders in transition, there's a temptation to back-to-back their journeys. You know, I use a metaphor of a trapeze artist. You know, you're sort of swinging trapezes and you want to hold on to the next trapeze before you leave the previous one. So can you talk a little bit about just maybe your experience of having done the sabbatical and therefore for people in transition, what would your advice be just in terms of going through a reflection process before figuring out what next?
Yeah, so I think it's not only in transition, right? So my sabbatical, my McKinsey sabbatical was basically I wanted to renew. And of course, you can see a transition as a renewal. But in the end, it's very important to withdraw yourself from your active life now and then. Because that's when creativity starts to waken up, when you really start to deeply rest, where you get new stimulus, where you can do things that you typically don't do when you're back to back in Zoom calls and meetings and other things. So I think the practice of retreat, whether it's a sabbatical or whether it is a 3-day silent retreat or whether it's a weekend walk in the mountains that you plan on your own, is a very, very healthy leadership practice. And I've done it all my life. So these sabbaticals are longer ones. I've done 2 of them. They were like 6 months. But I do shorter retreats every year.
Got it. And these are, just to maybe get tactical, how long are they? And can you expand on how you think about your retreats?
Well, anywhere between 3 days silent retreat or 10-day silent retreat, or the last years I've done a couple of more like active retreats where I was more like walking or, you know, but very often in nature. And there is a practice to it, right? So I go in there with an intention. It's not kind of like just doing nothing. I go in there with an intention to relax and discover and let new things emerge.
Got it. Thanks for sharing, Mikhail. Moving into the book, Deliberate Calm, you say that deliberate calm is not a leadership style or behavior, but a personal self-mastery practice. Can you say more about what it is, what you mean by the term deliberate calm, and why it's possibly all the more relevant today?
Yeah, so I mean, the words have been chosen specifically, and I must say, once we started to co-write it with the three of us, with Jackie and Aaron, we had long discussions also with the publisher about the title. And the first title was Leading and Learning Outside Your Comfort Zone. And for lots of reasons, we dumped that. But the deliberate calm is actually more describes a state that you're in. And deliberate is around choice. And it's around choice in high stake, volatile situations, being at choice in any situation, even the high stake, volatile ones. And deliberate is around, and calm is around emotionally calm. So being able to develop the capacity to hold uncomfortable emotions without being swept away by them. And that's, as a leader in a world where there's way more change than ever, and it's increasing every time. I mean, you know, we all experience that. There is the speed of change is also going faster, and it's getting more complex. So it's multi-stakeholder. So I often talk to CEOs that are just retired or retired 5 years ago, and they said, "I'm so glad I'm not a CEO today anymore," because the world has been so much, is so much more complex. The demands of the outside world on the business is so much bigger. You have to have an opinion on everything, you know.
Just if I may come in with a search consultant question, if I wore my Egon Zehnder hat for 30 seconds, just building on that question, on that point, Mikhail, from a leadership competency perspective, what are the 2-3 things that have become leadership asks of today that didn't exist maybe 5-10 years back in your mind?
Well, I think, I mean, I'm grossly simplifying this, right? But I think 10 years back, there was a generation of leaders that were super smart and knew where to take the company. And I think now we're looking for leaders who can connect with all the different stakeholders, who can hold a long-term view as well as delivering on the short-term, and who are adaptable and what we call have learning agility. So I don't think we're now looking for CEOs that can do what they've done before, because they've done it before, they think they know what to do, but we're actually looking for CEOs that have learning agility and that they understand the adaptive situation they're very likely in and that they can handle that.
And in the book, you talk about the learning zone versus the protection zone. Can you share a little bit around what you mean by these? Because in a way, that appears again and again and in the various case studies that you outline in the book. So can you talk to us about what these zones are? How do we know we are in these zones and the implication on leadership?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, learning protection is actually, it sounds like a very simple concept, but it's very profound. So as human beings, when we are entering into a situation, let's say we enter into a new room or we enter into a meeting or we sense whether it's safe or whether it's not safe. And when we feel it's safe, we can be in a learning state. When we feel there's a threat, we get in a protection zone. Mm-hmm. And when you're in a protection zone, it could even be like me entering into this podcast, right? That in the beginning, I'm kind of like a little, maybe a little anxious, not knowing what questions you're going to ask. And then kind of, I could very easily get a little bit into a protection zone. And then what I would start to do is I would feel a little anxious. I would try to have the right answers ready, so I'm prepared for everything that you ask. And I would very much hold on to that, right? So with that, I would lose spontaneity. I would not be playing with you around the questions and the answers. And it would become a very stale and overly prepared interview, right? Now, interestingly enough, whenever we work with executive teams, we start with explaining this concept of learning and protection. And then we ask them, if you look at your average board meeting, executive team meeting, how much time are you in protection? And how much time are you in learning? What do you think the percentage is?
I would say 30% learning, 70% protection, maybe.
Yeah, that's about right. And then when we ask them, when the topics get higher stake and the context gets more uncertain, what happens to the level of protection? Does it go up or down?
Yeah, I would imagine the guards go up.
It goes up, right?
1090, so whatever. Yeah.
So the inconvenient truth of this is that when we most need our collective wisdom, we most need our open minds, we most need to ask questions and look for new answers, that capacity is least available to us. And it's not because we're stupid or because we're bad, it's because we're biologically wired to be that way. So therefore, learning and protection is a simple frame to make us aware that we are either in protection in learning, and you can teach yourself to become aware of it, right? Because you feel it in your body, you hear it in the tone of voice, you feel it in the breathing, and you see it in each other. So that's why we use this a lot. And there are many, many teams that actually have made this a practice to call each other out on learning or protection states.
And is this linked to the concept of psychological safety that Amy Edmondson talks about? As a leader, one of your jobs is to create the safety so that people spend more time in the learning zone versus protection zone. Would that be a fair understanding?
Well, I think psychological safety is definitely meant to create more of a learning zone, right? And I think what we are trying to create with this concept is that it's okay to be in a protection zone. It's just not very helpful when you're trying to lead something, right? So, but it's a natural response to a certain situation that can create a protective response. The trick that we want to get teams to do is that they actually address it. that they check, mm-hmm. hey, are we in protection now? Are we in the right state to get this solved? Or mm-hmm. do we need to shift to learning?
Hmm. And what are the, maybe staying with that, Mikhail, what are some of the things to look out for a team to recognize that it's in protection zone versus learning zone? Are there obvious telltale signs that people could sort of be on the lookout for?
Yeah, I mean, people know it immediately when you point it out, right? Because the funny thing is, a team can be in protection, but never all the members of a team are in protection. Typically, there's something going on between two team members, or one team member is on his hobby horse and no one wants to challenge him. So there are always people that are kind of like neutral observers, and they don't act. They don't take responsibility for the learning of the team. But if they start to do it, they can actually lift the team up and get them into a learning state. So things to look for are we listening enough to each other?
Mm-hmm.
Do we let other people finish their sentences? Do we ask more questions than we tell things?
Mm-hmm.
And people recognize all these patterns. I mean, we had one team that spoke about, oh yeah, we know that we load and reload. So when someone is talking, we're already reloading, and then we shoot again with our own opinion.
Got it. And you referred to one of the things I loved in the book. You talk about active observers, if I'm not mistaken, right? Not passive observers, but
yes,
observers who are not just observing, but can sort of be a little more proactive in showing the mirror to how the group is doing, and therefore, move the group towards a learning state. Can you talk a little bit about that, about the responsibility of being an observer to a conversation?
Yeah, it's really about that. I mean, if you look at teams, right, if you have a team of eight people, all of you are never at the same time involved in the conversation. So there might be the chief marketing officer might be talking to the sales guy or girl, and they are having a intense conversation, and they might get in protection, and then they won't notice it because they actually are so passionately defending their points that they don't notice that they're not open anymore. Now, the other six can actually just raise their hand and say, hey, guys, are we in learning or in protection? It's very important to do that as a question or as a statement, because then you drive people deeper in protection if you do that.
Got it. Back to the book, Mikhail, one of the things you talk about quite a bit is this concept of dual awareness. And you use the term skylight in this context.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, awareness, I understand, but there's something specific you have in mind when you say dual awareness. So could you sort of expand on this one?
Yeah, dual awareness is, I think that's a new concept. I haven't seen it before. Brought together. I think that's what we're trying to do in this book, especially because the world has changed so much and there's so many high change situations that people find themselves in. So we want to make them aware of two sides, the external world and the inner world. So the external world, we basically ask people to make a judgment. The situation that you're getting into, is that a familiar zone situation where you know the answer, you know what to do? It might be high stake, it might be low stake, but it's clear what to do. Or is it an adaptive zone challenge where you actually don't, there's so much change going on that you don't exactly know what to do. And you need to enjoy the learning. That's the learning agility. If in situations like that, you're actually eager to learn, and you can focus everyone on learning and improving and finding the answers and moving, being adaptive. That's one. So that's the external awareness. And then we have the inner awareness around how do you respond to that? Now, these two things need to be in balance with each other, because if you have a high-stake adaptive zone challenge and you are not aware of your inner response, we just heard from the learning and protection discussion that you will be naturally wired to go into protection, and then you will contract and you won't be able to bring your potential to the situation. So That's where the inner awareness becomes very important around, hey, what are my thoughts, feelings, and body state when I'm entering a situation like this?
And what do you mean by the term skylight that you use in this context?
Yeah, so the skylight, I mean, that's in the old wisdom schools, people talk about the observer, right? Or the witness consciousness. You're witnessing yourself whilst you're in action. And the skylight is actually a simple metaphor practice where you imagine yourself looking down on yourself from a skylight, and you see yourself act. You feel yourself feel, and you listen to yourself talk whilst you're in action. And that's a very important practice to master. That witness consciousness.
And can you talk a little bit about how one gets there? What are some of the what are some of the approaches for people to build this muscle? Clearly, it's not a switch that gets activated overnight. But if you could expand on some of the ways people could build this dual awareness and the skylight to observe themselves.
Yeah, so there are a number of things, right? So you can build in your work practice. So let me start with work and then I go to personal. In your work practice, you can build in rituals to actually check with each other. Are we getting into an adaptive zone challenge? If we are, let's be really aware of how we respond to it, right? Because we know we are at risk of getting into protection. So let's be very aware and let's be very open to help each other get in learning, stay in learning, and notify when we get triggered in protection. So that's a practice that you can actually do before you get into meetings, or if you do it individually. If you look at your agenda, you can look at, hey, what are the external situations that will trigger intense emotions in me? Right? Now, then developing, this is a little bit almost like a pre-situation practice, right?
Before you enter the battlefield, kind of a practice.
Exactly, right? It's a locker room practice before you go into the field. Now, when you're in the field, that's actually when you need the skylight, and the way to practice that. I mean, we all have heard about mindfulness, right? So meditation is a good mindfulness practice where you can practice this skylight in the silence and the peace and quiet of not doing anything, but just sitting on your cushion. And that transfers to real life. So getting that same kind of like reflective mode whilst you're being in action, that's the practice. And then the third step is doing it afterwards, right? So you have a before, during, and after. Now, clearly, the during is the most difficult part. And people in business are actually not really trained in it, right? I mean, if you're an athlete, you're continuously in the competition and you get immediate feedback if something goes wrong and you have immediate responses. So they have rituals that are much more designed to actually develop this skylight capability. In the business world, it's a bit more difficult.
Interesting. Would you be able to share an example or two in terms of how athletes build that skylight in their training?
You see it. I mean, so, for example, I'm a competitive golf player, right? So I can use a golf example. But when you're playing golf, you actually train yourself to have a ritual where you visualize your shot. And then before you start getting into the action, you step into your performance box where you don't think anymore and you just trust your body and your training and you let the wisdom do the work, right? And when you make a mistake, you actually don't linger onto it. You know that, you know that you want to linger onto it, but you actually let go and you move forward. And then, you know, so, and when you look at tennis players, they all have their rituals, right? With their service and all the little things they do. And Nadal is a great example, right? I think he's probably the most impressive one of who does this.
Elaborate rituals. Yeah. Actually, it came up in my recent conversation with a gentleman called Ethan Cross of Michigan, who's written a book called Chatter. And he says that some of these rituals help us bring order, you know, give us, when things are not in control, you do a few things to tell yourself that, okay, there are a few things I can control and I have it sorted. And sort of in a way, he goes on to say that that sort of at least quietens down the chatter in our minds as we play the next point.
I think there's a difference between a tennis player and a businessman. That tennis players often know what the unproductive chatter is. When you're in business, a lot of CEOs have a little bit of an impatient demeanor, right? I'm generalizing again, but just as an example, many CEOs I work with were impatient and want to get things done quickly. They actually might believe that that's a helpful mindset. What they don't see is what the impact is on the team and that people are not committed to the decisions because they haven't really deepened them out enough. And then you cut corners, right? So it's quite important that you understand and you do work on yourself to understand, hey, what are the patterns that are useful and productive and what are the ones that are unproductive?
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. Sometimes accessing the skylight doesn't need elaborate practice. If we work hard enough to build the muscle of pausing and observing ourselves, we can slowly access that vantage point that Mikhail talks about. Rich Fernandez of Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute, which was first incubated in Google, suggests that we can bake in mindfulness in the small things we do to get there.
When people think about meditation, they think about having to do exactly what I just said, which is set aside, you know, X block of time and, you know, sit in a certain way and close your eyes and protect this space for formal practice. But there's also a way to practice mindfulness and meditation in an integrated way. So for example, as you move through the course of your day, integrate it into your day. Between meetings, you know, if you need to walk to the restroom, make that a walking meditation. I'm actually serious about that, right? Become aware of your body as it moves through space between your office and the restroom. Become aware of your footfall. Become aware of, you know, the felt sense of your body. How are you feeling actually in that moment? Or take the opportunity to focus on breath. Or this being in India, this podcast, you know, if you have a mantra that you're, you know, that you're familiar with or particularly like, use that. And I say mantra, and there's often a religious component to that. But here, what I'm referring to is really finding an object of your attention to train your attention upon it, whether it be mantra or breath or walking or sensation. You can really do this throughout the course of your day. I was driving to work today, and I was focusing on my breath, not so much so that I wasn't able to drive, but when there was a red light, when I was stopped in traffic, in and out for three breaths, I noticed my breath. Next stoplight, same thing. Integrated practice is also a helpful one.
Let's now get back to the conversation with Mikhail Kroot.
You know, one of the things that comes up in my coaching work, Mikhail, if I may build on, is, you know, so efficiency versus effectiveness. Sometimes, you know, I come across leaders who are very clinical and want to get on with it. But very often by doing that, you're right, it comes in the way of motivation. It comes in the way of maybe exploring new possibilities or deepening a solution or figuring out potential roadblocks and stuff that could take 5 more minutes, but could help you get to a better place. So
exactly
with you on that. I think building on self-awareness, Mikhail, in the book, you also talk about 5 levels of self-awareness. I found that interesting. Again, the way you've sort of laid out the ladder of self-awareness across these 5 levels. So would you be able to touch upon them and just sort of give a broad frame of how you think about these levels?
Yes, I can. So I think the levels are interesting as in there's a there's a development, right? You asked earlier around how do you develop this? Hmm. How do you develop this this skylight? And it's actually a long process. And even if you have it, sometimes it can drop away when the tension really gets high, right? So the phases are, it starts with unawareness. So you basically, you're not aware of your inner world. You're not aware of whether you're in adaptive or in a familiar zone. You could call that bliss, but it's basically unaware, right? You're unaware and you might be ineffective. Then you have this this delayed awareness. So, and we all have had that, right? So you're in a meeting and then you say something and then 2 seconds later you think, oh my God, I wish I wouldn't have done that because it came from a very reactive behavior. So you start to become aware of triggers that don't get the best out of you. You get in fight, flight, freeze behavior, but you see it only after the fact. Right? That's step one. Mm-hmm. Then you get to perceptive. You are aware in the moment. So you notice it in yourself in the moment, but you're not actually able to do something about it.
Hmm.
So it's kind of like, oh, there we go again. And then the next level is resilient. And this is quite masterful already because you're actually noticing in yourself that you're getting a trigger and you can redirect yourself in the moment.
Hmm.
Right. So I sometimes have it when I'm working with a team and I'm getting triggered into something and all of a sudden I see myself and say, oh, I'm actually very reactive. You know, I'm reacting to someone in the group. I don't agree with him. I'm getting into a fight and I'm not listening. Mm-hmm. And then I can push the pause button and say, oh, wow, I actually got into a protection mode now. Did you guys see that?
And then you call yourself out in those situations.
And that is actually very interesting because then you can see how you can redirect yourself. And it's actually, even though it might feel vulnerable, people actually find it quite strong that you can actually catch yourself. By the way, they've all seen it, right? Mm. So it's better that I call it out.
Preemptive strike.
Yeah. And then, so this is still all in the moment. And then there's another, that's the fifth phase, which is adaptive, right? There you start to identify a number of patterns that keep popping up for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I've had a pattern for a very long time that if I didn't feel trusted, it triggered my emotions. So I felt insecure and then I started to make my points very strong and I stopped listening.
Mm-hmm.
And once I started to see that it happened over and over again, I needed to go deeper and start working on that pattern of why do I need to feel trusted before I can actually relax into something? Mm-hmm. And why do I ask others to trust me first before I trust them? You know, so once I started to work on that pattern, at some point when I had rewired that, those triggers didn't show up anymore.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. In my work with leaders, I find that very often they start climbing the ladder of self-awareness from the bottom. You show them the mirror and shine the light on an issue that's in their blind spot. They take a baby step and move from level 1 to level 2 and start noticing the issue, at least in hindsight. Then they do some more work and start noticing it in the moment and move to level 3, where they're noticing the issue, but still are not able to regulate themselves. At that time, when they want to move from level 3 to level 4, I notice that very often they start telling themselves a story that they are like this only and start wearing their attitude on their sleeve. Like Marshall Goldsmith says in his book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, they often are reluctant to do the work to move from level 3 to level 4. And I find that this can come in the way of them unlocking their potential. especially at senior levels. In this podcast, many moons back, we spoke to Tasha Urich, a lady who's researched the topic of self-awareness for many years. When I asked her about her research methodology, she used an interesting phrase called self-awareness unicorns to describe some of the people she studied.
So we didn't set out to identify these people, and I'll define what a unicorn is in a second. What I originally thought was, all I have to do, you know, we developed and validated this very lengthy, comprehensive assessment of self-awareness. I thought all I have to do is go find a bunch of people who score high as rated by themselves and someone who knows them well, and then I'll crack the code of self-awareness. But what I discovered when we started to do that and we started to interview highly self-aware people is a lot of them, and I wouldn't venture a guess, but I'd say probably most, at least in our experience, had sort of always been like that. You know, you think about those people that are just naturally self-aware. It's just a way they're wired. And when we tried to figure out what they do to stay self-aware, they would literally say things like, you know, I've never really thought about that before. I don't know if I do anything consciously. And we were so frustrated. We were thinking, oh my gosh, how are we going to figure this out? And then it dawned on us that all we had to do was to replicate what I had seen with my coaching clients, right? Find people who didn't start out as self-aware, but who were able, you know, over the course of months and years of commitment and effort to learn to see themselves clearly. And so that's what we ended up doing. We searched the world. Basically, we used snowball sampling, which is you ask everyone you know to fill out the survey, and then they ask everyone they know. And it actually, we got all around the world in a very, very globally diverse sample. But what we found eventually were 50 people, 50, who not only were highly self-aware as rated by them and someone who knew them well, but they and the person who knew them well also basically established that they had improved their self-awareness. So there were checks and balances built into the system just because, you know, you sort of think about if I went up to 100 people and I said, hey, are you self-aware? Would you like to be a part of our study? I'm sure we'll talk about this later in the podcast, but most people are not very good judges of their self-awareness. So that was why, you know, we had to have all these checks and balances and it was very complicated. But once we found these 50 people, a couple of observations, there were no demographic patterns by gender, age, nationality, job type, industry. We had students. We had a Fortune 50 executive. We had stay-at-home parents. We had professionals, really just a broad swath of people. And what was so interesting to me about that is it showed us that almost anyone can improve their self-awareness if they learn some of the tips and tricks that the unicorns uncovered for us. And so it was just a really fun process. And by the way, the reason we called them unicorns is my research assistants were joking that like, oh, you want us to find self-aware people who didn't start out that way? Well, we might as well be looking for unicorns. So everybody thought that was so funny. And then, you know, when we did find them, we thought, you know, this is kind of the perfect term for these people. You know, it's hard to imagine that they exist, but when we found them, there was just so much we learned.
I guess you don't need to be an entrepreneur of a $1 billion startup. Whichever field you're in, are you willing to do the work to be a self-awareness unicorn? That's a real question. You might appreciate that when we started the Play to Potential podcast, even the concept of podcasting was relatively new. Now there are thousands of podcasts all around the world, and it's become super critical for us to show customer engagement metrics when we reach out to new guests for them to see if it's a good ROI on their time. If you're deriving value, I would really appreciate you taking a moment and sharing your review on Spotify, Apple, or any other platform you use to consume this content. Let's now get back to Mikhail Crute.
I think the other piece I picked up, which I found very interesting in the book, Mikhail, was you talk about the distinction between ambition and purpose. And I really liked one of the terms you use. You say ambition is finite, but purpose is not. It's infinite. So if we can tap into our purpose, I like that framing. People talk about it, but when somebody frames it that way, it sort of captures the essence quite beautifully. So can you expand on that?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, this is a very personal experience, has been a very personal experience for me as well, where I must say the first 14 years or so of my career, I was, I thought I was super passionate about my work, and I was, but I was also very ambitious. So a lot of it was around climbing the ladder. So every 2-3 years, you are talking to headhunters to see if there's something more exciting outside. And, you know, it's kind of like all about going up the ladder. And then when I got into my first transition moment in the US, when I had this thyroid infection, that's when I actually got connected with a deeper purpose, something that I really felt where, in a way, where my passion met the need of the world, right? Mm. Which is a great way to, I mean, if you can actually do something that you're super passionate about, which for me often has to do with creating a lot of personal growth for myself. Mm-hmm. And if that connects to something that is needed in the outside world, well, that's then you kind of have found a purpose that is also purposeful for others, right? So, and that is lasting. I mean, the moment I joined McKinsey to do this mindset and behavior work, I never looked back. I never looked at any other opportunities. I was just living the dream. I was living my purpose.
And you also say that growth, you sort of use the metaphor of working out in the gym, and you say that, you know, the muscle actually builds when we are resting during the phase of recovery. And you talk about physical, mental, emotional, social, and spiritual recovery. I loved the emphasis on recovery. Can you talk a little bit about your observation on how leaders think about this or don't think about this, and why this phase of recovery is important when we look at leadership effectiveness?
Yeah, I think recovery, and especially in times where adaptability and learning agility is so important, is critical. And it's a grossly overlooked dimension of leadership. So I think busyness is being celebrated and recovery is being overlooked. And I mean, it's like the physical metaphor is always easy, right? I mean, your muscles grow after you've done the workout. Your cognitive loading has a limit to it, right? I mean, you can do four hours of real deep, concentrated, high quality cognitive work in the day. And the rest you can do on a little bit more easy stuff or administrative stuff, but you can't do 8 or 10 hours of high quality work. So what starts to happen is that your presence starts to come down. Very high likely your cortisol and adrenaline levels go up, and you get into this busy mode. So it's important to notice in yourself that you build in those recovery periods, because that's when, one, your system can recharge, but it's also where new ideas come up, where you can actually work through things that have happened, and you can really actually process it so it doesn't leave any residue. And you just become a better long-term practitioner, leader.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. Unless we really focus on decluttering what's on our plate, I find that it's really hard to build recovery time in our life, whether it's exercise or leading a company or interacting with our family. Matt Dixon, a triathlon coach who trains the who's who in the valley, including Sir Michael Moritz of Sequoia, speaks about the criticality of recovery and the risk of dumping a training program on top of life.
And so the biggest mistake that we see people make is to think, I know I need to exercise because I know that's something to do that makes me really healthy. So how am I going to just add this on top of life? And many people, what they do, and a great example is, oh, it's wonderful, I've got a bunch of friends, I'm going to do Ironman Turkey and it sounds wonderful. And they, what does it take to train for that? And it takes 20 hours a week. Goodness me, I don't have 20 hours a week, but there's the training program and that's what I need to do. I'm going to dump it on top of life and I'm just going to have to find a way to cram it in. To be successful and to actually integrate the key components of rejuvenation and recovery, as well as training, what we have to realize is that we have to integrate it into a person's life so that not only can they improve in that discipline, because hopefully they're looking for improvement, but so that it can lift their health, it can lift their performance as a CEO or an executive, and it can help them thrive across all areas of life. And so it's all about integration. We go through a very particular process where we look at their habits at the start and we look at their genuine landscape of their life. What are the non-negotiables? And when we think about non-negotiables, there's obviously the commitments in the workplace. Quite often there's the commitment with their family, and we want them to be available and present for their family, their children, their wives, their husbands, whatever it might be. And then the other component that we have as non-negotiable is sleep. And saying, okay, how much are you sleeping? Is that necessary? And is it high enough quality, which is the other component of effective sleep, not just quantity? Are you getting enough? And with those building blocks in life, we have a certain amount of time left over. And that ebbs and flows with the different demands of life. But then we can go about saying the equation, with that time that is left over, how do we optimize it? How do we create an optimization mindset with that time that's left over? And that's a very different way of going about it. So rather than just dumping a training program on top of life or throwing a bunch of habits and saying, this is how you have to navigate, it becomes an all-encompassing recipe for them. And that's really where development of resilience and ultimately success comes from.
Back to McKeel. I also love what he says. Sometimes the best ideas come from the phase of recovery when we're not doing much, but our brain is subconsciously working on something. Leaving that space or margin in the notebook is often helpful for us to be more effective and creative. Let's now get back to the conversation with McKeel Crute.
And moving to group dynamics, McKeel, you know, in the book, you talk about moving from exploring icebergs individually to exploring the collective iceberg as a team, which I found really interesting. And in that context, you actually talk about a domino effect, which I found intriguing. You know, I was particularly curious about how something like a domino effect might play out in a family context. You know, my wife and I, we have two kids, 13 and 9. So there are these passages of play where each one of us is triggering the other. I love the notion of the domino effect. So if you could talk a little bit about this notion of the collective iceberg as a unit, but also this concept of the domino effect that sometimes we observe in groups.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about icebergs. So we spoke about awareness of your thoughts, your self-talk and your emotions and your body state. In a way, that's kind of like level one, right? You kind of see what's going on in the here and now, in your self-talk and in your emotions. What you don't know yet is where do they come from? What is driving those? Now, what's driving those has a lot to do with your history, right? The culture you grew up in, the values you hold, your beliefs you have about what success looks like, what's being expected of you. So that forms the next level of your iceberg, and that creates patterns. Mm-hmm. So we all walk into teams with our individual icebergs. And there is a collective team iceberg. So there's a collective, you have a collective family iceberg, I'm sure, right? Where you have some shared values, you have expected behaviors, and you kind of know what you want to create. The individual icebergs will bounce into each other. Right, and you very often see that with if you bring it to the family with children, right? So in the birth order, they very often pick different icebergs. So they, by definition, they bounce into each other, right? Because they and if they have the same, they're competing. The icebergs are competing. So in business teams, you see people, and we talk about the domino effect because the triggers react on each other. the triggers of people react on each other. So if I have a high need for respect, what I call respect, people listening to each other in the team, and I have a colleague that has a high need for speed and decision making, then his, what in my view would be shortcutting a discussion, will trigger my need for respect and listening to each other. Mm-hmm. And then we're going into this dance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's you see that all the time. And when people start to see it, so we often do this trigger exercise where people share their allergies in the team, right? What are we allergic for? And it's very funny because you can immediately show, even not having worked with the team, I can point out the behavioral patterns that will be happening in this team.
And I guess it's almost like a nuclear chain reaction with no cadmium rods, right? Just there's no control. And maybe back to the point you made, that's where either an active observer or a collective skylight, where we are able to catch ourselves and maybe raise a hand and say, which mode are we in, can sort of change the dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the interesting thing about our biology, it's very predictable. And it's also, we also know how to manage it. So if you're in this intense, you know, stuckness, very busy getting nowhere, very intensely busy getting nowhere, and someone raises his hands and say, hey, we often call it, let's take a balcony moment. Then within 20 seconds, people look at each other and they restart the conversation and they're at the level of learning. Because your amygdala disengages. This whole limbic reaction system disengages when you take a breather.
And in that moment, is there a ritual or two as a team that you suggest? Or is it just even giving 30 seconds is often enough to reset that conversation?
Well, asking the question, let's take a balcony moment. And then what often is good is to just do a quick round of, hey, how do we feel? And then you get back into the discussion.
Now, what I love about that is it doesn't point fingers at an individual. It just sort of points to the temperature in the room to say this is not helpful, and goes around the room and resets the temperature, if you will, to have a more productive dialogue. Very often in these situations, it becomes gets personal very quickly, you know, and gets one-on-one and gets bilateral.
Yeah, that's the point. So you have to make it more normal than normal that this happens. And you also shouldn't make it a deeply psychological therapy session every time that this happens, because then you can't get anything done, right? So there's a place for that as well if you go deeper into the patterns. But when you're in business meetings, it's actually good to have a way to quickly move through this and get back into learning.
It's a great point. Yeah, there is a risk of overdoing it and not getting work done and sort of going down a rabbit hole, which often is not productive in a business context. Got it. And as you think about your work, Mikhail, are there specific nuances that come about when people work with teams in a virtual context? You know, some of these things end up taking slightly different shapes and forms when 8 different people are in different locations. Any additional nuances you'd like to throw on how to sort of handle the collective iceberg when you're distributed?
Yeah, sometimes it makes it easier because it's easier to kind of like, people don't talk so much through each other, right? There's less talking at the same time in Zoom meetings or Teams meetings. Yet you need to spend more time on the fabric of the team, in a way, right? So you need to do a little bit more check-ins and check-outs. Like, are we actually feeling good with this conversation? Did everyone feel heard, and are we aligned on what we decided? I think being a little bit more explicit about doing those checks at the end and before you discuss, talk a little bit about what people want to get out of it, makes it a deeper dialogue, because you can't read the body language that well.
Got it. I think the other question I had was, of the various things you discuss in the book, are there a few things that you feel people get cognitively but struggle to put it into practice? You know, what's been your experience in terms of getting it here versus really driving behavioral change?
Well, I think your recovery is definitely one, right? I think the busyness is very hard to give up for people. It's actually very hard for people to think that being in recovery is actually good for your work. That's hard to, unless you actually give yourself an amount of time to experience it and see that it actually works. It's a hard concept to get. I think the other thing is, you need to build in rituals for all of these things, right? If you don't make it a practice, then it all makes sense. People say, oh yeah, no, that makes sense. But if you don't make rituals to make the hard things easy, right? It's very hard to call someone on protective behavior if you haven't created a ritual around it, because then it very easily starts to feel like, oh, this is personal. It's very hard to practice your skylight if you don't do it regularly, right? If you don't start to develop this awareness of your self-talk, of your emotions. I mean, very often when we start working with people, they can mention two emotions. They feel good or bad. And that's kind of like their, you know,
vocabulary.
And I think if you really want to practice your awareness, you need to expand your vocabulary about your feelings a little bit. So you know where you're actually at. Right. So it mastery does take practice, and actually making your mind and your presence practice important, as important as your craft practice, like being a good marketing guy or sales guy or industry guy, whatever, is important.
Got it. Mikhail, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. You know, as we wrap up, I find it interesting to get different people's take on this theme and what the term means to them. What does the term play to potential mean to you?
Yeah, I would change a word if I'm allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I would make it play with potential.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in this time of massive change, the game is a lot around, where is the potential that I can play with in myself, in others, and in the outside world? So the with versus the two, it feels like the two potential, you almost have a visual what the potential looks like. And I think the playing with potential is a continuous active looking for the great things and the opportunities and the possibilities and adapting and, you know. So I like it a lot, actually. I mean, I like to play to potential because it triggered the with potential in me.
I love it. In a way, as you're speaking, I'm just thinking aloud, it's a distinction between sort of looking at the moon from a distance versus playing with a horse that you can ride. You know, it's almost the way you're describing it is like potential is there. You can access it, but it's just a question of what you want to do with it and how you play with it.
That's exactly the point, right? So I think the potential is there. It's always there. All that gets in the way is ourselves, right? It's our unawareness. It's our blind spots. It's us getting caught up in old ways of doing things that made us successful in the past. That gets in the way of full potential.
I love it. If I may relate, one of the guests, when I asked this question, he said, I like the term play to potential because you can't work to potential. You can only play to potential. So
that's also true. The play probably triggered the with in me. Yeah, it's nice.
True,
yeah.
True. I hadn't thought of that interpretation when I named it play to potential. It was intuitive, but when he sort of pointed out the distinction, I thought it was interesting. But now the two and the with nuances quite profound as well. Mikhail, thank you. Thank you so much for your time and for your insights on the podcast. Really valuable.
Thanks. I enjoyed it, Deepak.
Thank you for listening. If you're seeking value from the podcast, do take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you consume the content. This small act will make a big difference to us in terms of being able to reach people that could get value from this, and also attract higher caliber of speakers as we move forward. Given the proliferation and the number of podcasts that are being produced, these things have become that much more important as we move forward. Thank you for listening and your attention, and look forward to having you tune into one of the other conversations of the podcast. As I'd mentioned at the outset, the podcast is about 20% of my time. My primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a discreet sounding board to leaders. If you wish to know more about my advisory work, you could visit playtopotential.com and check out the About Deepak section. Thank you, and bye now.